Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. What does it mean to be sick? In the medical world, we often divide things into acute and chronic illnesses. Acute like pneumonia, something that's usually self-limited, and chronic illnesses like diabetes, things that need to be managed over a long course of time to reduce complications. Critical illness occurs with severe infections, trauma such as car accidents, or events like strokes or heart attacks. Which brings us to an entirely new concept brought about by medical technology, which sounds inherently paradoxical: chronic critical illness. Devices like mechanical ventilators, which we also call breathing machines, heart pumps, or artificial kidneys, allow us to keep people alive longer than nature might have intended. But what happens when there is no recovery, and people continue using these machines indefinitely in a kind of medically induced purgatory? My guest today, physician and writer Daniela Lamas, has thought deeply about people in these situations because she cares for them in her role as a pulmonary and critical care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Formerly a reporter for the Miami Herald, Lamas's new book is called You Can Stop Humming Now, A Doctor's Stories of Life, Death, and In-Between, and it's those in-between places at which Lamas's reporting really excels. Daniela Lamas, critical care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Daniela Lamas, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start and just ask you what you mean by the term, which sounds paradoxical, of chronic critical illness. I've never heard that before until you kind of introduced it to me, but it sort of makes sense in a way.
Thank you. So chronic critical illness, I agree, it entirely sounds paradoxical. You think that you are either in the midst of an acute critical illness or you have recovered, but there is a small percentage of people, estimated to be 100,000 or likely more in the U.S. at any one time, who do not die as a result of a catastrophic infection, pneumonia, trauma, neurologic problem, but they don't really get better either. So these are people who end up being hooked to ventilators longer term, who end up essentially always needing life support machines to keep them alive, although they are not acutely ill. So they're no longer on medicines to support their blood pressure. They no longer need the moment-to-moment monitoring of an intensive care unit, but they're still really sick. So unless they have an amazing amount of support, they likely can't go home either. And these patients often end up either staying in a hospital or going to what's called a long-term acute care hospital. So it's a hospital where the average length of stay is more around a month, and measures of success are very different than in an acute care hospital where length of stay is much shorter. The goal is really to get people home. So chronic critical illness, it's something that we don't really talk about very much because we don't really see it that much either. These patients leave our ICUs largely and go to these long-term acute care hospitals where often the doctors that take care of them in the ICU don't rotate. So when they leave, we don't really see the trajectory of care, and we don't see what it does to the patient, and we don't see either what it does to the caregiver who stayed with them. You know, through these sort of ebbs and flows, often people return back to the hospital for infections and things like this. In a year's time, after the acute illness that brought somebody to this state, about half of chronically critically ill patients will have died, and only around 1 in 10 will be alive and independent at home.
You said half will have died within how long?
So a year after the event that began the acute critical illness, so a year after the pneumonia or the car accident or the neurologic trauma, half of these patients will have died, around half will have died. And this has been true, these stats have been true over many studies over many years. And about 1 in 10 will be alive and functionally independent at home. So more might be home, but not able to do things on their own.
And you write about that beautifully. A couple of things. One is that you are very honest about the fact that in training, and you are now, you know, an attending pulmonologist, critical care physician, responsible for caring for patients in acute at Brigham and Women's Hospital, a very famous hospital in Boston, for people who are critically ill. But you point out that in your training, just like my training or anybody else's, we don't spend time in those long-term acute care hospitals. We don't really know where it is that people go. And we just sort of have this vision of this place once we've kind of stabilized the patient enough to get them to that next level of care. And what you're also honest about is that you thought of it, or at least initially when you set out, I think, to write this book or a series of essays, that you thought of it as kind of a purgatory. But I think you interviewed enough, met enough patients who are in this type of situation that, you found sort of a mixed blessing. I think for some it really was a purgatory, but for others it was a very meaningful type of life. And I guess I'll ask you about a couple of the ones you feature in your book. And in fact, you mentioned that 10% statistic that of people who survive critical illness in acute care hospital, only 10% are likely to be independent after a year, which is, we would think of as pretty dismal odds. And yet that reflects a great amount of success in our ability to care for these people. But you have a chapter called The 10% where you contrast a Mr. O'Brien with another character you call Charlie Atkinson. And I guess tell us their stories, if you can, in a nutshell, how they turned out a little differently.
Definitely, I'll tell you about them. And just also make sure that I didn't misspeak, just for people who are listening, that the 10% is really of people who don't get better from their critical illness right away. So of people who end up in this chronic critical illness state where they need a machine to be more permanently connected to the ventilator, they're delirious, they might have recurrent infections. So of those, the 10%, not of everybody who ends up in an ICU. So just want to clarify.
Thank you. That's excellent. Yeah.
So Mr. O'Brien and Charlie Atkinson. So I juxtapose these two characters. And Mr. O'Brien was a patient, or the man I call Mr. O'Brien. Charlie Atkinson is a gentleman who does go by his actual name. Mr. O'Brien was a patient that I met early on in my fellowship. So in my subspecialty training, we had a rotation where we went through a place called the Respiratory Acute Care Unit. It doesn't really matter what it's called, but it's another unit in the hospital where patients go when they leave the ICU. They're better enough to go out of the ICU, but they're not good enough to leave the hospital. And it's a place where we try to get people who are having trouble getting off the ventilator. For some, we succeed. Others end up in long-term acute care hospitals and sort of go down this path. And some others, they just stay in the RACU because they never even get stable enough to leave the hospital. Mr. O'Brien was one of these. And when I met him, he had been in the hospital for about a year's time, and his wife had to. I met him one day on a moonlighting shift, so a shift I just took for some extra money. And his wife had many questions, none of which I could answer, as I had no longitudinal view of Mr. O'Brien's care. But I remember them because I remember knowing from the notes that she had been in the hospital for so long and that he had too, and that it seemed when I met him that there was no way that things could be okay. And everybody defined okay differently. But he was not awake. He was not having meaningful interactions with the outside world. He seemed to be in pain. And our teams had conversations with his wife, and I think that the hopes that she had for him just never became reconciled with reality. And I met him again some months later, and in that setting, I actually was one of the doctors who was caring for him when he suffered another acute event. Something brought him back to the intensive care unit, and he ended up dying in the intensive care unit. And I think we had all known that his wife was unrealistic. We obviously knew it. But I don't think we had known the depth of her suffering until later in the night when after he died, when she called back the intensive care unit, and she asked the intern who was taking care of her husband if he could possibly call down or check the morgue, because she wasn't sure that her husband had actually died. And that barrier, that distinction between life and death, had become so murky in the days and weeks and months that she had lived there at his side that she couldn't even tell anymore. And I think that really gave me this window into this tragedy and into the fact that that woman needed so much more support than we at the hospital had given her. But in that RACU, in that same place, another man had passed through, and Mr. O'Brien went in and he got stuck, but a different man, Charlie Atkinson, who I met a little later in his course, he had been in that same place. He had been in the RACU, hooked to a ventilator, delirious. But he got better. He got better enough to go from the RACU to another unit, long-term acute care unit, which is where I met him. And when I met him, he was cognitively there. He was intact, but he still could not walk very well, still couldn't breathe without the ventilator. But Charlie managed to go home. Charlie was, when I met him, not quite the 1 in 10 because he wasn't independent at home, but he was definitely in the minority. He went home with his ventilator. He had a great support system and financial resources. Went home with his ventilator, ended up getting off the ventilator at home. And every time I have seen him, and I have followed with him for some years really now, he has a good quality of life. The choices that he's made and what he's gone through aren't things that everybody would, but he does not regret any of them. And I juxtapose those two stories to say that you know, looking from at hindsight, you know, these two people look totally different. But there was a moment at some point where both Mr. O'Brien and Charlie Atkinson could have been expected to have similar outcomes, and they didn't. And it is hard to know, but it's not impossible to know when they diverge. And I think, to me, that speaks to the fact that, you know, we can't just have one conversation, this is the way it's going to be. No, we say, you know, it might be this way, it might be this way. And as we move forward in time and see what actually comes to pass, we can better and better prognosticate. But, you know, it is always hard. It's always hard to know who is going to be Charlie Atkinson. But also, I think you have to ask who has it in them to be Charlie Atkinson, because somebody else faced with his same prognosis could have made entirely different choices, and those two could have been appropriate.
And you write so beautifully about Charlie Atkinson, how he had a party at the one-year mark of his hospitalization and survival. And then he's also, I think, he made it to his 60th college reunion, where you draw this picture of him in a top hat and tails. I mean, it's really just remarkable. And in spite of the fact that he still, for example, has a permanent indwelling urinary catheter, I mean, he's made some compromises, but he's living his life very much the way he wants. And you point out it's a very high quality of life.
Yeah, and I think that was definitely powerful to witness, because, you know, when you don't see people's longitudinal course, you can go one of two ways. One, you might just be unrealistically rosy, but there's also the risk that you see people and you think, God, how could they ever get better? And I think it's important to see that it's not just this, you know, miracle. Like, he worked really hard, and that what he did are things that not everybody would want to do, but to be able to really understand how those courses play out and how some people can surprise you positively as well.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Daniela Lamas, who is a critical care physician and pulmonologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and author of the new book, You Can Stop Humming Now, A Doctor's Stories of Life, Death, and In Between. And an area that you explore, Daniela, is this in between so well. And you have already alluded to the fact that as a critical care physician, you often come in at these extreme situations in people's lives when they are critically ill. But I think with your journalistic tendency, you really look for the longer form narrative of what happens to people kind of afterward. And in fact, you have started your very own clinic, which is kind of unusual, a post-intensive care clinic. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. So one of the things that I write about in the book, but one of the things that are now known in critical care medicine, is that it's very easy to gauge the effects and the benefit of ICU interventions in things like 30 or 60 or 90-day mortality or time on the ventilator. But only recently, critical care doctors have started to say, hey, what is the quality of these people's lives? Like, what does it actually look like? And have found that people who even look okay, they don't look like Mr. O'Brien or Charlie Atkinson, somebody who walks into your office and you say, oh my God, you look great after all you've been through. They might be doing great, but they also might be suffering some things that we don't really have a clear mechanism to follow up on and intervene on. And a significant percentage, so up to a third of people who've survived an ICU stay, sick enough to need a ventilator. They might have post-traumatic stress. They might have new anxiety, new depression, and have difficulties with their thinking, to the extent that it might be somewhat like somebody who suffered a traumatic brain injury or maybe even mild Alzheimer's. And they might also have physical debility. That's easier to see. But we don't have a structured way to follow these people up, to screen them for these problems, to give them appropriate referrals. It doesn't really make sense, though theoretically it would be great if the primary care doctors could also deal with this, you know, on top of the millions of things they do, but it doesn't make sense really time-wise. And also, you know, I think it is strange that critical care doctors are some of the only doctors that never see their patients after interventions. You know, you come back to your surgeon, you come back to your cardiologist after a heart procedure. So we started this clinic, a post-intensive care clinic, inspired largely by those at Vanderbilt in Nashville, who have one of the larger clinics in the country and have done a lot of work in this area. And the goal is for us to see patients who have survived an intensive care unit stay and have the potential to do well. I mean, we're not going to track somebody back into a clinic if their overall prognosis is really poor. But if they've survived and have a potential to do well and were sick enough, needing a ventilator, that they might have some of these problems, we want to bring them back into clinic, and we want to screen them for these problems. We want to answer questions that they might have about their intensive care unit stays. We want to make sure they're not on medicines that were started there that they could deal without. And we want to talk to them about how they're returning to their lives. And it's a clinical service. You know, we want to help people, but I think it's also a learning. And every patient I talk to, I learn something. Even patients who come in and are doing totally fine, I learn something from them, too, about the range of recovery after these events. So that's sort of our clinic in a nutshell.
Well, I think it's really admirable, and it does go so much against what seems like the current grain of, you know, I know lots of critical care doctors whom I admire greatly and who do some of the hardest work in, you know, the world of medicine, and yet it's sort of like once you are out of that ICU, you know, you don't necessarily follow that patient. So it's really fascinating to think about what happens to people. And you have a whole chapter in the book, too, on nightmares after the ICU, what is now widely recognized, I think, is post-ICU syndrome, or PICS, which didn't even really exist too long ago. But there was this pioneer that you write about, someone called Nancy Andrews, who experienced that. I guess she had Marfan syndrome, which I guess not necessarily important, but had undergone a lot of surgery and trauma in her life and wound up as an art professor, art teacher. And so she drew these fascinating pictures of some of her nightmares, and that was kind of how you found her. And it was really just absolutely fascinating chapter. I mean, this is what makes this book so much beyond the medical. I want to ask you about just a couple of other instances of what we might call medical purgatory that you again detail. I have a chapter on each. One is something called an LVAD. It stands for left ventricular assist device. And you have this really remarkable chapter about this man who, tell us what an LVAD is. And I mean, you really pushed my knowledge on this. So people are now living, at least as you write in the book, for some as long as 7 years with this battery-powered device to help their heart pump. And I suppose we're only at the limits of understanding how far someone can go with that. It's not an artificial heart per se. So what exactly is it?
Yeah, so it's a machine, works as a pump. And so what it does is the machine is implanted in the body, and it sucks blood out of one of the chambers in the heart, so one of the places sort of where the blood lands and moves through, and then shoots it into the aorta, so the main blood vessel that carries blood through the body. And the kind of patient who might be a candidate for this device is a patient who has heart failure. So their heart is really failing to pump. And to the extent that they are unable to walk up the stairs without getting winded, fluid accumulates in their legs and their lungs. It's a very dangerous state. And were there an infinite number of potential hearts for transplantation, potentially all the patients who would have a VAD would go to transplant. But there are not limitless hearts for transplantation. And also some patients, a transplant is a huge procedure, and some patients aren't able to tolerate that. And so for these patients, there's the question of a VAD, either as something that can maybe bridge them to transplant to allow them to get healthier and exercise and get their bodies tuned up for transplant, or as the way they live until the end of their life. And either of those brings with it significant trade-offs, but also potential benefits.
And so in this case, the LVAD was much more became a destination rather than a bridge to transplant. And that was what I guess is so surprising. But as you pointed out, he was not really a candidate for a heart transplant. And not only that, there obviously is a scarcity of hearts that are available to transplant. And so how long did he wind up living with this device?
He lived with the VAD. Van passed away. So the gentleman I'm talking about had the VAD for about on to his third year when I met him. And then he ultimately lived about 4 years with the device.
You know, you actually went out and saw him. He lived in a more rural area, and one of the things he was most interested in was, I think, teaching his grandson how to fish.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are battery-powered electrical devices. You cannot get them near water, and you talk about how just to take a shower, he has to spend 3 hours kind of preparing and waterproofing, sealing the device in a bag and everything. I mean, it's really talk about a change in your quality of life, and yet he actually, even though I guess some of his family members were incredibly disappointed when he was deemed ineligible for a transplant because of his history of smoking, he was actually kind of relieved to know that he sort of wasn't on call waiting all the time. He could just go on with his life wearing this battery-powered device.
Yeah, that was really powerful for me. I was quite surprised. I had met him thinking that he would be somebody who was angry and that maybe we would explore decision regret in our conversations, and it wasn't that at all. A lesson I learned about the fact that, you know, people react differently, and what's tolerable to one person is different than what's tolerable to the next. We can't know until we ask. So it was really valuable.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Daniela Lamas, who is a pulmonologist and critical care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She's also a researcher. She's part of something called Ariadne Labs and has just written the fabulous new book called You Can Stop Humming Now, A Doctor's Stories of Life, Death, and In Between. And Daniela, there's one more device that I had to ask you about because it's just so darn interesting. And the way I learned about it was back in the days of when I did a rotation in pediatrics. We talked already about the LVAD for failing hearts, and this is more, I guess, for failing lungs. It goes by the acronym ECMO. I'll let you explain what it is and, I guess, tell us a little bit about the patient in the book.
ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. So basically, this is a device that, exactly as you said, supports failing lungs. So how does it work? It replicates the function of the lung. And the way it does this, and this, unlike the VAD, lives fully outside the body. And importantly, you can't go home with it, because there needs to be a lot of attendants who make sure that its functioning is appropriate minute to minute, second to second. So there is a large catheter that goes into one of the big veins that lead into your heart. These are big veins in your neck or in your groin. And the catheter draws out this blood. The blood is dark. When it is drawn out, it does not have oxygen in it. The oxygen has been taken up by your body already. And then it runs it through what's called an oxygenator. So it adds oxygen to the blood, this machine that sits outside your body in the room, the size of a small air conditioner, runs blood through it, gives it oxygen, takes out carbon dioxide, doing what your lungs would do if they could, and then transports it through another catheter back into your body to use the new oxygenated blood. So why might somebody require this? So ECMO is used in one of two settings, kind of similar to the VAD, although you can't go home with ECMO. It's either a bridge, so really bad lung failure from flu or something like this, you could be supported on ECMO until your lungs recover, and then your own lungs will be back again, ideally. Or it's a bridge to a transplant. So it's either a bridge to recovery or a transplant. There's no destination for ECMO because you cannot live on this indefinitely. You can't leave the hospital with it. And so I met a patient who was put on ECMO as she waited for a transplant because she became unexpectedly extremely sick and was unable to maintain oxygen levels that would keep her alive with the ventilator alone. And so she was put on ECMO, and one sometimes can wake up while on ECMO, and she was awake. And to remain a candidate for a transplant, she had to stay physically fit. And so she walked around the intensive care unit with these catheters coming out of her neck, going into this machine that was being manned by two to three, they're called perfusionists, so the respiratory therapist in charge of this machine. And she did that every day, knowing that if she became weak enough so that she could not walk, she would fall off the list for transplant, and there was no potential for lung recovery for her, so that would be it.
My goodness. I mean, it's just so hard to picture somebody walking around with this burden.
Yes. Apparently, she described that even just lifting her head up, because she had, so that people can walk, they often move one of the groin catheters to the neck as well. So it's this dual catheters, big catheter in the neck, and just lifting her head up, she described, it's just like unimaginable weight that she had to hold.
Well, I don't want to sort of spoil any more of the book, but I guess let's just say, at some point, she was able to come off the ECMO in sort of a positive way, and we'll just leave it at that. I want to shift gears for a second and ask you a little bit about your background, which is, to me, is slightly unusual in that before you became a doctor, you were a journalist. You actually were a reporter at the Miami Herald. Tell us about that.
I've always loved writing, and I've always also loved the idea that I can have a sort of reporter's passport to just go in anywhere and ask people questions and I have to answer it. And so in college, that became my great passion. I was keeping up my pre-med courses, but became the editor of our daily paper and loved it very much and thought seriously, but always seriously-ish, because I was always taking all the pre-med courses of becoming a reporter. And then ultimately decided that I did want to experience that in the real world for some period of time. And so I was lucky enough to work at the Miami Herald as a medical reporter in the year prior to medical school. And I ultimately left to go to medical school, clearly, not without a great deal of, I think one of the reasons I'm so interested in how people make, these impossible decisions is that my own decision-making process is terrible. And I was tortured for a while about what I had chosen, but ended up coming to love medicine and learning that I could continue writing as well.
Well, and you clearly have melded the two because you have become a medical journalist as a practicing physician. I mean, you're frequently published in the New York Times, it seems like. You work in what's called Ariadne Labs, that's affiliated with Brigham and Women's Hospital. And the head of Ariadne Labs is a famous doctor writer himself, Atul Gawande. Is he somewhat of a mentor to you?
Yes. It is not a coincidence that I sought out the opportunity to do research at Ariadne. Not only was there Atul Gawande, there's a fantastic palliative care clinician, actually, named Susan Block, who is one of the people with whom he worked closely on the sort of conversation elements that are in Being Mortal, and who became one of my mentors and also worked at Ariadne. So that was sort of my link. But yes, he has been, he's extremely kind, clearly very smart, and is really sort of unparalleled, I think, at sort of reframing problems and trying to tease out the key components of what can make a simple solution and understand what kind of outcomes we could try to aim to change to improve care.
Well, I want to ask a little bit about your research, because your most recent New York Times piece was about a patient who came in who did appear to have an advanced directive stating that he did not want any advanced life support or to be intubated or hooked to a ventilator should that situation arise. But the article goes on to talk about how, if not for sort of the dumb luck of the residents just happening to see that in the electronic medical record, that the emergency room physicians who were dealing with kind of the critical nature of this person's illness didn't really see that. And it's sort of the Swiss cheese effect of multiple holes lining up. And so you've actually done some, it looks like, qualitative research in this area, trying to ascertain why it is that we have people, you know, having these difficult conversations and then those wishes not getting expressed. Is that something you could share with us?
Yeah, so I am quite interested, probably because of enjoyment of reporting. I feel like qualitative research is something that is interesting and a skill that I, you know, would like to hone and to sort of learn to do that well, you know, as a science. And so in this project that you're talking about, I was interested in coming up with a set of recommendations that informed by sort of key stakeholders that would ideally, if implemented, allow us to have a better accessibility and accuracy of advanced care planning documents in electronic health records, because it's a big deal. Patients can go from one hospital to another, and even if they did the very best of having a conversation with their doctor, if that other hospital is on a different electronic health record and the patient doesn't bring something with them or they're too sick to remember to tell the doctor, then everybody starts again. And if nobody can tell you what happened, you know, we rightfully so err on the side of being more aggressive. And so that is a way that people get care that's not consistent with what they want and aren't sort of protected from getting that care. And so did a sequence of interviews of clinicians and members and those who work on electronic health records and those who make policy surrounding this, and, you know, really believe that it would be very important if there were a base set of standards for all electronic health records, as there are for allergies, that would say that you need a certain amount of information accessible through, you know, one window, through one main click, and I won't go on and on about the electronic health record, but basically it was an example of saying, like, care could be better through this kind of solution. And how does that turn into policy? That's going to be a whole other set of questions. I hope that at least by writing about that in the lay public as well, there's a little more movement than, you know, a journal article. But that was one of my interests, sort of looking behind the scenes and saying, even if we do everything well, why are these things not happening right? And I think, you know, I think that this this problem is one of those.
Well, congratulations to you on the book. The name of the book is You Can Stop Humming Now. My guest today, Daniela Lamas, she's a critical care and pulmonary physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and on faculty at Harvard Medical School. It's her stories of life, death, and the in-between. Daniela Lamas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's really my pleasure.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.